scars, changing bodyguards. It pains her, as a pious Muslim, that some fundamentalists want to kill her in the name of Islam. She leans forward and becomes even more animated. "From my heart, I tell you, if they were educated, they would not behave like that. The Quran has quotation after quotation that says you must treat women well. Those people who do bad things, they are not educated. I am a Muslim. My father was a good Muslim, and he prayed every day. But he did not try to marry me off. There were many offers for me when I was in the sixth grade, and he said no. That is why these people are afraid of educating women. They are afraid that then the women will ask questions, will speak up. That's why I believe in education. It is such a powerful tool to overcome poverty and rebuild the country. If we took the foreign aid that goes to guns and weapons and just took one quarter of that and put it into education, that would completely transform this country." Sakina shakes her head in exasperation and adds, "The international community should focus on education. On behalf of the women and children of Afghanistan, I beg you. If we are to overcome terrorism and violence, we need education. That is the only way we can win." Chapter 10, Investing in Education. If you think education is expensive, try ignorance. Derek Bach. As a newly married couple living in China almost 20 years ago, we came to know a scrawny 13-year-old girl in the hardscrabble Dabia Mountains of central China. The girl, Dai Manji, lived with her mother, father, two brothers, and a great-aunt in a dilapidated wooden shack on a hillside, a two-hour hike from the nearest road. The family members had no electricity, no running water, no bicycle, no wristwatch, no clock, no radio, virtually no possessions of any kind, and they shared their home with a large pig. The family could afford to eat meat just once annually to celebrate the Chinese New Year. There was almost no furniture in the dim shack, except for a coffin that the father had made for the great aunt. "I'm healthy now," the great aunt explained cheerfully, "but it's best to be prepared." Dai Manji's parents were elementary school dropouts and barely literate. They didn't see much point in girls getting an education. Why would a woman need to read or write when she was going to spend her days hoeing fields and darning socks? The school fee, $13 a year for elementary school, seemed a waste of the family's tattered banknotes when the money could be used for something useful, like buying rice. So when Dai Manji was entering the sixth grade, they told her to drop out of school. A short, thin girl with stringy black hair and a timid air, Dai Manji was a head shorter than an average American 13-year-old would be. She couldn't afford textbooks or even pencils and paper, but she was the star pupil in her grade, and she yearned to continue her education. "My parents were ill, and they said they couldn't afford sending me to school," she said shyly, looking at her feet and speaking so quietly she was barely audible. "Since I am the oldest child, my parents asked me to drop out and help with the housework." She was hanging around the school, hoping to learn something even if her parents wouldn't pay the fees, and she still dreamed of becoming the first person in her family to graduate from elementary school. The teachers doted on Dai Manji, giving her old bits of pencils and scraps of paper, hoping to support her studies, and they introduced us to her when we first visited the school. On our next visit, Dai Manji led us on a 4-mile hike up a foot trail to her shack to visit her parents. We wrote an article about her in 1990, and a sympathetic reader in New York wired us $10,000 to pay for her tuition through his bank, the Morgan Guarantee Trust Company. We conveyed the donation to the school, which was exultant. "Now we can educate all the children here," the principal declared. "We can even build a new school." The money was indeed used to construct a much improved elementary school and to provide scholarships for girls in the area. When a fair amount of money had already been spent, we called the donor to give him a report. "You were very, very generous," we said, genuinely enthused. You wouldn't believe how much difference $10,000 will make in a Chinese village. There was a startled pause. But I didn't give $10,000, he said. I gave $100. After some investigation, it turned out that Morgan Guarantee had erred. We called up a senior Morgan Guarantee executive and asked him on the record if he intended to dispatch bankers to force children to drop out of school to make up for the bank's mistake. Under the circumstances, he said, we're happy to make a donation of the difference. The villagers were mightily impressed by American generosity and carelessness. Since Daimanji was the one who had inspired the gift, the authorities provided her with tuition-free schooling as long as she was able to pass exams. She finished elementary school, junior high school, and then the equivalent of accounting school. She found work in Guangdong Province as an accountant for local factories. After she had worked there for a couple of years, she found jobs for friends and family members. She sent growing sums of money home to her family so that her parents became among the richest in the village. When we made a return visit a few years ago, Daimanji's parents were rattling around a 6-room concrete house. The great aunt had died. There was still a pig, but it lived in the old shack, which was now a barn. The family had electricity, a stove, a television, and a fan. Daimanji married a skilled worker, an expert in molding, in 2006 and had a baby girl the following year when she was 30 years old. She was working as an executive in a Taiwanese electronic company in the town of Dongguan, but she was thinking of starting her own company. Her boss agreed to support her, and it seemed to offer her an opportunity to become a Daguan, or tycoon. Because of all the scholarships funded by Morgan Guarantee, many other girls on the hillside had also enjoyed an unusual spurt in education and gone off to find jobs in the factories of Guangdong. They sent money back home and helped pay to educate their younger siblings, who eventually also found good jobs in coastal China. All this brought the hillside more prosperity and influence, and so a road was built to the village, going right by the new Dai home. Someday, there may be a statue there of the donor, or of Daimanji, or of a muddled bank clerk. That is the power of education. One study after another has shown that educating girls is one of the most effective ways to fight poverty. Schooling is also often a precondition for girls and women to stand up against injustice, and for women to be integrated into the economy. Until women are numerate and literate, it is difficult for them to start businesses or contribute meaningfully to their national economies. Unfortunately, the impact of girls' education is quite difficult to examine statistically. Few areas of development have been more studied, but those conducting and financing the research have mostly been so convinced of the virtues of educating girls that the work hasn't been very rigorous. The methodology of such studies is typically weak, and it doesn't adequately account for cause and effect. The evidence, in most cases, suffers from obvious biases. Educated girls come from richer families and marry richer, more educated, more progressive husbands, notes Esther Duflo of MIT, one of the most careful scholars of gender and development. As such, it is, in general, difficult to account for all these factors, and few of the studies have tried to do so. Correlation, in short, is not causation. Advocates also undermine the trustworthiness of their cause by cherry-picking evidence. While we argue that schooling girls does stimulate economic growth and foster stability, for example, it is also true that one of the most educated parts of rural India is the state of Kerala, which has stagnated economically. Likewise, two of the places in the Arab world that have given girls the most education were Lebanon and Saudi Arabia, yet the former has been a vortex of conflict and the latter a breeding ground for violent fundamentalists. Our own view is that these are exceptions. Kerala was held back by its anti-market economic policies, Lebanon by competing religious sects and bullying neighbors, and Saudi Arabia by a deeply conservative culture and government. But the world is complicated, and whenever we see a silver bullet, we try to conduct an assay test. Education isn't always a panacea. All those caveats noted, the case for investing in girls' education is still very, very strong. Anecdotally, we know of many women who, with education, were able to obtain jobs or start businesses and transform their lives and the lives of those around them. More broadly, it's generally accepted that one of the reasons East Asia has prospered in recent decades is that it educates females and incorporates them into the labor force in a way that has not been true of India or Africa. A few studies with unimpeachable methodology examined the consequences when there was a huge expansion in schooling for girls, even those from poor or conservative homes. Between 1973 and 1978, for example, Indonesia vastly increased school attendance. One study by Lucia Brera-Rova and Professor Duflo of MIT suggests that this led women to marry later and have fewer children. Educating girls had more of an impact than educating boys in reducing fertility. Similarly, Una Ossoli of Indiana University and Bridget Long of Harvard examined a vast expansion of primary education that began in 1976 in Nigeria. They concluded that each additional year of primary education leads a girl to have 0.26 fewer children, a considerable reduction. It's often said that a high school education is what's most crucial, but this study found that even elementary education has a vast impact on fertility. The challenges are manifest. Of the 115 million children who have dropped out of elementary school, 57% are girls. In South and West Asia, 2/3 of the children who are out of school are girls. Americans often assume that the way to increase education is to build schools, and in some areas that is necessary. We ourselves have recently built a school in Cambodia, like those students in Seattle under Frank Grijalva, but there are drawbacks. School construction is expensive, and there is no way to verify that teachers will do their jobs. One study in India found that 12% of all schools were closed at any time because teachers had not gone to work that day. One of the most cost-effective ways to increase school attendance is to deworm students. Intestinal worms affect children's physical and intellectual growth. Indeed, ordinary worms kill 130,000 people a year, typically through anemia or intestinal obstruction, and the anemia particularly affects menstruating girls. When deworming was introduced in the American South in the early 20th century, school teachers were stunned at the impact. The children were suddenly far more alert and studious. Likewise, a landmark study in Kenya found that deworming could decrease school absenteeism by a quarter. The average American spends $50 a year to deworm a dog. In Africa, you can deworm a child for 50 cents, says Peter Hotez of the Global Network for Neglected Tropical Disease Control, a leader in the battle against worms. Increasing school attendance by building schools ends up costing about $100 per year for every additional student enrolled. Boosting attendance by deworming children costs only $4 per year per additional student enrolled. Another cost-effective way of getting more girls to attend high school may be to help them manage menstruation. African girls typically use and reuse old rags during their periods, and they often have only a single torn pair of underwear. For fear of embarrassing leaks and stains, girls sometimes stay home during that time. Aid workers are experimenting with giving African teenage girls sanitary pads, along with access to a toilet where they can change them. Initial findings are that this simple approach is effective in increasing female attendance at high schools. Femcare, the arm of Procter & Gamble that makes Tampax tampons and Always pads, started its own project to distribute free pads in Africa, but it ran into unexpected challenges. First, the girls needed a place to change their pads and clean up, but many schools lacked toilets. So Femcare began building toilets with running water at the schools, and that added hugely to the costs. Then the project encountered cultural taboos about blood, such as resistance to disposing of used pads in the garbage. Femcare had to make special provision for the disposal of pads, in some places even distributing incinerators. The project was an education on both sides, and the outcome was a familiar one. Because corporations want their brand to be associated only with the best, they often support gold-plated projects that are very impressive but not particularly cost-effective. Another tantalizingly simple way to boost girls' education is to iodize salt. Some 31% of households in the developing world do not get sufficient iodine from water or food. The result is occasional goiters and, much more frequently, brain damage when children are still in the womb. Fetuses need iodine in the first trimester to develop proper brains, and both human and animal studies show this is particularly true of female fetuses. A study in Ecuador suggests that iodine deficiency typically shaves 10 to 15 points off a child's IQ. Worldwide, iodine deficiency alone reduces humanity's collective IQ by more than 1 billion points. According to one estimate, just 19 million would pay for salt iodization in poor countries that need it. This would yield economic benefits that another study found were 9 times the cost. The result is that while salt iodization is one of the least glamorous forms of assistance possible, development geeks rave about it. Alternatively, a capsule of iodized oil can be given every 2 years to all women who may become pregnant, at a cost of only 50 cents per capsule. Research by Erica Field of Harvard focused on Tanzania, where these capsules were given to women in some areas beginning in 1986. Professor Field found that daughters of those women given capsules managed to stay in school markedly longer and performed better. Still another smart strategy to expand girls' education is bribery. Nobody uses that word, but that's what it amounts to. One of the pioneers is Mexico, where in 1995, the deputy finance minister, Santiago Levy, was alarmed that the crash of the peso and resulting recession would be devastating to the poor. The existing anti-poverty program, built around food subsidies, was inefficient and served the needs mostly of food companies. So Levy quietly organized an experimental anti-poverty program far away from the capital, in Campeche, where it wouldn't arouse interest or opposition. The essence of Levy's idea was to pay poor families to keep their children in school and take them in for regular medical checkups. Records were carefully kept, tabulating the results in villages where the program was introduced and in a control sample of comparable villages. Afterward, Levy showed President Ernesto Zedillo how successful the experiment had been, and Zedillo bravely agreed to phase out food subsidies and launch the new program nationwide. The program is now called Oportunidades. About 1/4 of Mexican families are served in some way by Oportunidades, and it is one of the most admired anti-poverty programs in the world. The poor get cash grants in exchange for keeping children in school, getting them immunized, taking them to clinics for checkups, and attending health education lectures. Grants range from $10 per month for a child in the third grade to $66 for a girl in high school. Grants are highest for high school girls because their dropout rates are highest. The payments are made directly by the central government to reduce local corruption and to mothers rather than fathers. That's because research has shown that mothers are more likely to use cash for the children's benefit and because the payments elevate the status of the mothers within the household. Oportunidades provided for rigorous evaluation, something that is lacking in too many aid programs. In this case, outside experts get contracts to perform the evaluations, making comparisons with control villages. Villages are assigned randomly either to the experiment or to the control group, so that it is possible to measure how well the program worked. The outside evaluators, the International Food Policy Research Institute, rave about the program. After only 3 years, poor Mexican children living in the rural areas where Oportunidades operates have increased their school enrollment, have more balanced diets, are receiving more medical attention, and are learning that the future can be very different from the past. The World Bank says that the program raised high school attendance by 10% for boys and 20% for girls. Children in the program grow 1 centimeter taller per year than those in the control group. In essence, Oportunidades encourages poor families to invest in their children the way rich families already do, thus breaking the typical transmission path of poverty from generation to generation. Oportunidades is particularly beneficial for girls, and some early studies suggest it will pay for itself by creating more human capital to power Mexico's economy. The program is now widely copied in other developing countries, and even New York City is experimenting with paying bribes to improve school attendance. Bribery comes into play as well in the UN's school feeding program, run by the World Food Program, WFP, and UNICEF, and long championed by former Senator George McGovern. Typically, the WFP distributes food to a rural school, and local parents provide the labor to prepare daily meals with it. All the children at that school get a free meal, usually an early lunch, on the assumption that they've had no breakfast, as well as regular deworming. In addition, girls with good attendance often get a take-home ration as an inducement to parents to keep educating them. "This helps keep girls in school," said Abdu Mohammed, principal of the elementary school in Seberasu, in a remote grassy plain of Eritrea in the Horn of Africa. He watched the students lining up as parents ladled stew onto their plates and added, "Now students can concentrate. They can follow the lesson. And we haven't had any girls drop out since the feeding program started, except for those who got married. Girls used to drop out in 5th grade. School feeding programs cost just 10 cents per child per day, and researchers have found that they considerably improve nutrition, reduce stunting, and increase school attendance, especially for girls. But money is short, so the WPF says there are some 50 million children who could benefit from the program but don't. The approaches we've discussed have proven effective at increasing school attendance, but there's also the question of how to increase learning once the children are in school. One especially cost-effective way to do that is to offer small scholarships to girls who do well. A study in Kenya by Michael Kremer, a Harvard economist, examined 6 different approaches to improving educational performance, from providing free textbooks to child sponsorship programs. The approach that raised student test scores the most was to offer the top 15% of girls taking 6th-grade tests a $19 scholarship for 7th and 8th grade, and the glory of recognition at an assembly. The scholarships were offered in randomly chosen schools, and girls did significantly better in those schools than in the control schools, and that was true even of less able girls who realistically had little chance of winning a scholarship. Boys also performed better, apparently because they were pushed by the girls or didn't want to endure the embarrassment of being left behind. Aid to these kinds of programs is of proven benefit, but not all aid programs are created equal. So in the last few years, there has been a backlash against calls for more foreign aid. Skeptics such as William Easterly, a New York University professor who has long experience at the World Bank, argue that aid is often wasted and sometimes does more harm than good. Easterly has unleashed withering sarcasm at the writings of Jeffrey Sachs, the Columbia University economist who has evangelized indefatigably for more aid to fight malaria and AIDS and to help countries fight their way out of poverty. Other economists have noted that it's difficult to find any correlation between amounts of aid going to a country and development in that country. As Raghuram Rajan and Arvind Subramanian put it in a 2008 article in the Review of Economics and Statistics, "We find little robust evidence of a positive or negative relationship between aid inflows into a country and its economic growth. We also find no evidence that aid works better in better policy or geographical environments, or that certain forms of aid work better than others. Our findings suggest that for aid to be effective in the future, the aid apparatus will have to be rethought." We're great admirers of Bono, who has been indefatigable in support of aid for Africa and who knows the subtleties of development. He talks poverty policy as well as he sings. Yet when Bono spoke at an international conference in Tanzania in 2007, he was heckled by some Africans who insisted that aid isn't what Africa needs and that he should back off. Andrew Mwenda, a Ugandan, complained about the calamitous consequences of the international cocktail of good intentions. James Shikwati of Kenya has pleaded with Western donors, "For God's sake, please just stop." The skeptics make some valid points. Anybody traveling in Africa can see that aid is much harder to get right than people usually realize. In 2000, a World Health Conference in Nigeria set a target. By 2005, 60% of African children would use bed nets to protect them from malaria. In reality, only 3% were using bed nets in 2005. There is also a legitimate concern that aid drives up the local exchange rate of African countries, undermining business competitiveness. Even simple interventions, such as stopping mother-to-child transmission of HIV in childbirth, are more difficult to get right than anyone sitting in an armchair in America might imagine. A $4 dose of a drug called nevirapine will normally protect a baby from infection during childbirth. So this intervention has been dubbed the low-hanging fruit of public health. But even if a pregnant woman gets an AIDS test, and even if she goes to a hospital to deliver, and even if the hospital has nevirapine and the efficiency to administer it, and even if the woman is taught not to breastfeed the baby for fear of passing the virus in her milk, and even if the hospital gives the mother a free supply of infant formula and teaches her how to sterilize the bottles, even then, the system often fails. Many women simply discard the formula in the bushes outside the hospital as they walk home. Why? Because the women feel that they simply cannot feed a baby from a bottle in an African village. Every other villager would immediately realize that they were HIV positive and would ostracize them. While empowering women is critical to overcoming poverty, it represents a field of aid work that is particularly challenging in that it involves tinkering with the culture, religion, and family relations of a society that we often don't fully understand. A friend of ours was involved in a UN project in Nigeria that was meant to empower women, and his experience is a useful cautionary tale. The women in this area of Nigeria raise cassava, a widely eaten root, vaguely like a potato, and use it mostly for household food, while selling the surplus in the markets. When the women sold the extra cassava, they controlled the money, so the aid workers had a bright idea. If we give them better varieties of cassava, they'll harvest more and sell more. Then they'll make more money and spend it on their families. Our friend described what came next. The local women's variety of cassava produced 800 kilos per hectare, and so we introduced a variety that got 3 tons per hectare. The result was a terrific harvest. But then we ran into a problem. Cassava was women's work, so the men wouldn't help them harvest it. The women didn't have time to harvest such huge yields, and there wasn't a capacity to process that much cassava. So we introduced processing equipment. Unfortunately, this variety of cassava that we had introduced had great yields, but it was also more bitter and toxic. Cassava always produces a little bit of cyanide-related compound, but this variety produced larger amounts than normal. So the runoff after processing had more cyanide, and we had to introduce systems to avoid contaminating groundwater with cyanide. That would have been a catastrophe. So we dealt with that, and finally the project looked very successful. The women were making a lot of money on their cassava. We were delighted. But because the women were making so much, the men came in and kicked the women out of the cassava fields. The tradition was that women raise staple crops and men raise cash crops. And the men reasoned that if cassava was so profitable, it must now be a man's crop. And so the men took over the cassava, and they used the profits for beer. The women had even less income than when we started. So let's freely acknowledge that Murphy's Law plays a role in the aid world. Foreign assistance is difficult to get right, and it sometimes is squandered. Yet it is equally clear that some kinds of aid do work. Those that have been most effective have involved health and education. In 1960, 20 million children died before the age of 5. By 2006, that figure had dropped below 10 million, thanks to campaigns for vaccination, sanitation, and oral rehydration to treat diarrhea. Think about that. An extra 10 million children survive each year now. An extra 100 million per decade. That's quite a success to weigh alongside the many failures of aid. Likewise, through his philanthropic efforts, Jimmy Carter has almost succeeded in wiping out guinea worm, an ancient parasite that has afflicted humans throughout recorded history. Or consider the $32 million that the United States invested over 10 years in the global battle to eradicate smallpox. Some 1.5 million people once died annually from smallpox. Since it was eradicated in 1977, about 45 million lives have been saved. That's an astonishing total. And the United States recoups its $32 million investment in smallpox every 2 months, simply because Americans no longer need to pay to be vaccinated against it. Because of the money saved by eradication, that investment has yielded a 46% annual return in the 3 decades since smallpox was eradicated, a better investment than any stock in that period. Anne and Angeline. Angeline Mugwenderi's parents were impoverished farmers in Zimbabwe, and she was mocked by classmates when she went to school barefoot and in a torn dress with nothing underneath. Teachers would sternly send her home to collect school fees that were overdue, even though everyone knew there was no way her family could pay them. Yet Angeline suffered the humiliations and teasing and pleaded to be allowed to remain in school. Unable to buy school supplies, she cadged what she could. "At break time, I would go to a teacher's house and say, 'Can I wash your dishes?'" she remembers, "and in return, they would sometimes give me a pen." At the end of primary school, she took the nationwide 6th grade graduation examinations and had the best score not only in her school, but in the entire district. In fact, one of the highest marks in the nation. Yet she could not afford to go to secondary school. She was inconsolable. Angeline was destined to be another farmer or village peddler, another squandered African asset. Local people have a saying for it: those who harvest the most pumpkins are the ones who lack the pots to cook them. In other words, the brightest children are often born into families that lack the means to educate them. At that moment, though, Angeline's career intersected with that of Anne Cotton, a Welsh woman, very Welsh, she says, trying to help girls in Zimbabwe. Anne has a finely tuned social conscience, nurtured as she grew up in Cardiff, surrounded by family stories of mining and political struggle. She absorbed a passion for education and set up a center for schoolgirls with behavior problems, but her life found a deeper focus only after tragedy struck. After a smooth pregnancy, Anne gave birth to her second child, a baby daughter named Catherine. The baby seemed healthy, and they returned home from the hospital. When Catherine was 10 days old, a midwife came for a routine visit to check on the baby. She told Anne to rush the child to the hospital, that her life was in danger. At the hospital, a team standing by with a mobile oxygen tent took Catherine and placed her inside. Catherine, it turned out, had a congenital lung defect. The alveoli, which transmit oxygen from the lungs into the blood, were not supplying her bloodstream with adequate amounts of oxygen. So the little girl's heart and lungs were failing. For the next 6 weeks, Catherine lived in an oxygen tent. Anne, her husband, and her son more or less lived in the hospital, becoming close with many other young parents whose children were in danger. "Such agony," Anne recalls. "I have never felt so helpless. As a mother, I was powerless to help my daughter. It was the greatest pain I have ever experienced." The doctors and nurses worked heroically to save Catherine's life, but they couldn't. "All we knew when she died was that we would honor her life and all she had taught us," Anne says, "but how to honor her wasn't clear." Anne's life was soon hectic with another boy and girl for a total of 3 surviving children. Then Anne's husband took a job in the high-tech industry in Boston, and since Anne couldn't get a work permit under American visa rules, she enrolled in Boston University to study international relations. That revived her academic interests, and Anne later began a master's program in human rights and education at the University of London's Institute of Education. As part of her program, Anne set off on a 3-week visit to a particularly poor part of Zimbabwe to research the low school attendance rates there among girls. The conventional wisdom was that for cultural reasons, many African families resisted sending daughters to school, and Anne brought along stacks of questionnaires and notepaper to probe that resistance. She focused on a school in a village called Mola, talking to children, parents, and school officials. She quickly realized that the big challenge wasn't culture, but poverty. Families didn't have the money to buy books and pay school fees for all their children, so they gave preference to their sons because it was more likely that boys could use the education to get good jobs afterward. Anne was stirred by the determination of Zimbabwean girls to get schooling. She met 2 teenage sisters, Cecilia and Macarita, who had hiked 60 miles to Mola because it was cheaper than the school near their home. They invited Anne into the makeshift hut they had built, and they confessed that they didn't know where the money would come from to attend school the next term. It all reminded Anne of her grandmother's stories of Wales in harsher times, and it made her feel a kinship with these girls in the Tonga tribe in a remote nook of Zimbabwe. She imagined her own children enduring such deprivation. "I was confronted by a level of poverty I had never before seen," Anne says. She promised the local people that she would find a way to support girls' education. Village chiefs and school officials were enthusiastic, and they held a community meeting in which they pledged grassroots support for an initiative to educate girls, if Anne could help defray the costs. Upon her return to her home in Cambridge, England, Anne was obsessed by the memories of those girls she had met. She and her husband started their own fund and asked friends and relatives for donations to pay the school fees for the girls in Mola. But that wasn't enough. Anne is not an enthusiastic cook and had never done anything commercial, but she started making sandwiches and cakes at her kitchen table and peddling them in a stall at Cambridge Market to raise funds for the girls. It was not a brilliant financial success. One freezing February day, Anne and 2 friends stood all day in the cold and brought back just £30. Anne managed to raise enough money that first year to send 32 girls to high school, and their parents followed through on their pledges to support their daughters and make sure they attended school faithfully. 2 years later, Anne turned her efforts into a formal organization, the Campaign for Female Education, or CAMFED. One of the first girls whom Anne supported was Angeline. She went on to high school and, to nobody's surprise, performed brilliantly. CAMFED has expanded from Zimbabwe into Zambia, Tanzania, and Ghana, and it has won honors for its successes, enabling it to raise more money and expand further. CAMFED's budget is still tiny compared to the big agencies, $10 million annually, but it now helps more than 400,000 children attend school each year. Right from the start, CAMFED had only local staff in each country. There's a strong emphasis on ensuring that the community buys into the program, and it is a committee from the local community that chooses the girls who will get scholarships. CAMFED staff review decisions to make sure that there is no corruption. Moreover, CAMFED has avoided the cult of personality that afflicts some aid groups. CAMFED's website is about the schoolgirls, not about Anne, and there isn't a word about her baby Catherine who inspired it all. We had to pry that out of Anne. These kinds of grassroots efforts usually achieve more than the grand UN conferences that receive far more attention. We highlight CAMFED partly because we believe an international women's movement needs to focus less on holding conventions or lobbying for new laws and more time in places like rural Zimbabwe, listening to communities, and helping them get their girls into schools. For CAMFED, support for a child typically begins when she is in elementary school, as part of a broad program to support needy students. Then, when the girls graduate from primary school, CAMFED offers a full support package for high school, including shoes and a uniform if necessary. If a student lives too far from a high school, CAMFED helps arrange for her to live in a dormitory and covers the costs. CAMFED also supplies sanitary pads and underwear to all the girls so that they do not miss school during their menstrual periods. Anne and others have had to face the additional problem of sexual abuse by teachers. Particularly in southern Africa, some teachers trade good grades for sex. Half of Tanzanian women and nearly half of Ugandan women say they were abused by male teachers, and one-third of reported rapes of South African girls under the age of 15 are by teachers. If a girl feels that if she goes and talks to the teacher in private, she'll be fondled, then she's not going to do well, Anne says. She also notes that Westerners sometimes create problems by sponsoring scholarships to be awarded by teachers or the principal. The scholarship winners are sometimes the prettiest girls, who, in return, are expected to sleep with the principal. CAMFED avoids this problem by having the girls selected by a committee without giving a central role to the principal. CAMFED supports its girls after they graduate from high school in starting a business or learning a skill such as nursing or teaching. Or, if they achieve sufficiently high grades, they are supported through college. CAMFED has also started microfinance operations, and some of the girls are starting dairy farms or other businesses. CAMFED alumni have also formed a social network, trading ideas and engaging in public advocacy on behalf of women's rights. In Zimbabwe, for example, the graduates have banded together to call for tougher action against sexual abuse of girls. The graduates have also pushed to discourage routine virginity testing of teenage girls, a traditional practice to promote chastity, as well as campaigned against arranged marriages. In Ghana, a CAMFED graduate named Afeshtu was the only woman running in the district assembly elections in 2006, and she won. Now she has her eye on a seat in the national parliament. Perhaps the greatest surprise is that CAMFED alumni have themselves become philanthropists. Even though their incomes are tiny by Western standards, they still support other schoolgirls. Anne says that CAMFED's high school graduates are each helping an average of 5 other girls at any one time, not counting their own family members, whom they also support. They are becoming real role models in their communities, Anne says. It may be that the neighbor's child can't go to school because she doesn't have a skirt, so she'll provide that. Or maybe she'll pay another girl's school fees. This was something that we didn't expect at all. It shows the power of education. Speaking of role models and the power of education, CAMFED Zimbabwe has a new and dynamic executive director. She's a young woman who knows something about overcoming long odds and the impact a few dollars in tuition assistance can make in a girl's life. It's Angeline. Chapter 11. Microcredit, the Financial Revolution. It is impossible to realize our goals while discriminating against half the human race. As study after study has taught us, there is no tool for development more effective than the empowerment of women. Kofi Annan, then UN Secretary General, 2006. Saima Mohammed would dissolve into tears every evening. She was desperately poor, and her deadbeat husband was unemployed and not particularly employable. He was frustrated and angry, and he coped by beating Saima each afternoon. Their house, in the outskirts of Lahore, Pakistan, was falling apart, but they had no money for repairs. Saima had to send her young daughter to live with an aunt because there wasn't enough food to go around. "My sister-in-law made fun of me, saying, 'You can't even feed your child,'" Saima recalled. "My husband beat me up. My brother-in-law beat me up. I had an awful life." Sometimes, Saima would take the bus to the market in Lahore, an hour away, to try to sell things for money to buy food. But that only led her neighbors to scorn her as a loose woman who would travel by herself. Saima's husband accumulated a debt of more than $3,000, and it seemed that this debt would hang over the family for generations. Then, when Saima's second child was born and turned out to be a girl as well, her mother-in-law, a crone named Sharifa Bibi, exacerbated the tensions. "She's not going to have a son," Sharifa told Saima's husband in front of her, "so you should marry again. Take a second wife." Saima was shattered and ran off sobbing. Another wife might well devastate the family finances and leave even less money to feed and educate the children. And Saima herself would be marginalized in the household, cast off like an old sock. For days, Saima walked around in a daze, her eyes red, and the slightest incident would send her collapsing into hysterical tears. She felt her whole life slipping away. It was at that point that Saima joined a women's solidarity group affiliated with a Pakistani microfinance organization called Kashaf Foundation. Saima took out a $65 loan and used the money to buy beads and cloth, which she transformed into beautiful embroidery to sell in the markets of Lahore. She used the profit to buy more beads and cloth, and soon she had an embroidery business and was earning a solid income, the only one in her household to do so. Saima brought her eldest daughter back from the aunt and began paying off her husband's debt. When merchants wanted more embroidery than Saima could produce, she paid neighbors to work for her. Eventually, 30 families were working for Saima, and she put her husband to work as well. "Under my direction," she explained with a twinkle in her eye. Saima became the tycoon of the neighborhood, and she was able to pay off her husband's entire debt, keep her daughters in school, renovate the house, connect running water to the house, and buy a television. "Now everyone comes to me to borrow money, the same ones who used to criticize me," Saima said, beaming in satisfaction. "And the children of those who used to criticize me now come to my house to watch TV." A round-faced woman with thick black hair that just barely peeks out from under her red and white checked scarf, Saima is now a bit plump and displays a gold nose ring as well as several other rings and bracelets on each wrist. She dresses well and exudes self-confidence as she offers a grand tour of her home and work area, ostentatiously showing off the television and the new plumbing. She doesn't even pretend to be subordinate to her husband. He spends his days mostly loafing around, occasionally helping with the work, but always having to take orders from his wife. He is now more impressed with females in general. Saima had a third child, also a girl, but that's not a problem. "Girls are just as good as boys," he explained. "We have a good relationship now," said Saima. "We don't fight, and he treats me well." "And what about finding another wife who might bear him a son?" Saima chuckled at the question. "Now nobody says anything about that." Sharifa Bibi, the mother-in-law, looked shocked when we asked whether she wanted her son to take a second wife to bear a son. "No, no," she said. "Saima is bringing so much to this house. She's an exemplary daughter-in-law. She puts a roof over our heads and food on the table." Sharifa even allows that Saima is now largely exempt from beatings by her husband. "A woman should know her limits, but if not, then it's her husband's right to beat her," Sharifa said. "But if a woman earns more than her husband, it's difficult for him to discipline her." Saima's new prosperity has also transformed the family's educational prospects. She is planning to send all three of her daughters through high school and maybe to college as well. She brings in tutors to improve their schoolwork, and her youngest child, Javaria, is ranked first in her class. We asked Javaria what she wanted to become, thinking she might aspire to be a doctor or lawyer. Javaria cocked her head. "I'd like to do embroidery," she said. Saima is an unusually successful participant in the microcredit revolution sweeping the developing world. In place after place, Markets and microlending are providing a powerful system to help people help themselves. Microfinance has done more to bolster the status of women and to protect them from abuse than any laws could accomplish. Capitalism, it turns out, can achieve what charity and good intentions sometimes cannot. Kashof is typical of microfinance institutions in that it lends almost exclusively to women, in groups of 25 who guarantee one another's debts and meet every 2 weeks to make their payments and discuss a social issue. Topics include family planning, schooling for girls, or hudud laws used to punish rape victims. The meetings are held in the women's homes in rotation, and they create a women's space where they freely discuss their concerns. Many Pakistani women are not supposed to leave the house without their husband's permission, but husbands tolerate the insubordination because it's profitable. Women return with cash and investment ideas, and over time, they earn incomes that make a significant difference in household living standards. Typically, the women start small, but after they have repaid the first loan in full, they can borrow again, a larger amount. This keeps them going to the meetings and exchanging ideas, and it builds the habit of dealing with money and paying debts promptly. "Now women earn money, and so their husbands respect them more," said Zora Bibi, a neighbor of Saima who used Kashof loans to buy young calves that she raises and sells when they are grown. "If my husband starts to hit me, I tell him to lay off, or next year I won't get a new loan, and then he sits down and is quiet." Kashof is the brainchild of Roshana Zafar, a Pakistani woman who sounds more like a banker than an aid worker. Roshana grew up in a wealthy, emancipated family of intellectuals who allowed her to study at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania and later earn her MA in development economics at Yale. Many of Roshana's friends in Pakistan and at Wharton wanted to get rich, but she wanted to save the world, and so she joined the World Bank. "I didn't want to create wealth for people who were already wealthy," Roshana said. "I thought I would go to the World Bank and make a difference. But it was like screaming against the wind. Everywhere we went, we would tell people to use better hygiene. And they would say, 'You think we're stupid? If we had money, we would.' I wondered what we were doing wrong. We had mega million-dollar projects, but the money never got down to the villages." Then Roshana happened to find herself seated at a dinner next to Muhammad Yunus, the ebullient Bangladeshi professor who much later won the 2006 Nobel Peace Prize for pioneering microfinance. Yunus wasn't famous then, but he was attracting interest in development circles for starting Grameen Bank, which championed loans for poor women. Roshana had heard stories of Yunus's success and quizzed him over dinner. He talked animatedly about Grameen's work, and it was exactly the kind of pragmatic grassroots effort that she yearned to join. So Roshana took a leap of faith. She quit her job at the World Bank and wrote a letter to Yunus telling him that she wanted to become a microfinancier. He promptly sent her an air ticket to Bangladesh. Roshana spent 10 weeks there, studying the work of Grameen. Then she returned to Lahore and set up the Kashof Foundation that helped Saima. Kashof means miracle, and at first it seemed a miracle would be needed to make it work. Pakistanis told Roshana that microfinance was impossible in a conservative Muslim country like Pakistan, that women would never be allowed to borrow. In the summer of 1996, she started combing poor neighborhoods, looking for clients. Roshana discovered, to her horror, that women were reluctant to take money. "We went from door to door attempting to convince women to start a credit relationship with us," she recalled. Finally, Roshana found 15 women willing to borrow and handed out 4,000 rupees, $65, to each of them. Roshana brought in another dynamic Pakistani woman, Sadaf Abid, who had studied economics at Mount Holyoke College. Roshana and Sadaf made a striking pair. Well-educated, well-connected, well-dressed, and beautiful, they prowled through poor villages, looking to ordinary Pakistanis more like movie stars than anyone's idea of bankers. And for all their brilliance, Roshana and Sadaf ran into difficulties because they had no intimate knowledge of the poverty they were trying to defeat. "We only had 100 clients, and 30 of them were delinquent," Sadaf remembers. Relentlessly empirical, focused on refining their business model, Roshana dispatched Sadaf to be branch manager in a poor village, but even that proved difficult. "Nobody would rent to us because we were an NGO, a non-governmental organization, and an NGO full of women," Sadaf said. Many Pakistanis also believed that no unmarried woman of honor would leave her parents' home and live on her own, so the Kashaf women's staff attracted leers and frowns. In later years, Roshana had to bend to reality and hire some male branch heads, because it is so difficult to find women willing to relocate to poor villages. Roshana and Sadaf spent their first few years tweaking the business model. Because delinquent loans were a problem, they began tracking loan payments daily rather than weekly. A loan officer began doing basic checking on a client's credit worthiness. Does she buy from the local grocery store on credit? Does she pay utility bills? But mostly, the model depended on lending to a group of 25 women who would all be responsible if any one of them defaulted. That meant that those women did their own screening for fear of admitting a weak link. Finally, Kashaf had a system in which virtually 100% of loans were repaid in full, if not by the borrower, then by other members of the group. Kashaf then began expanding rapidly, more than doubling each year since 2000. Kashaf also began offering life insurance and health insurance, as well as home improvement loans. Roshana wanted to require that legal title to the home be transferred to the wife before the home improvement loan could be extended, but transfer of title in Pakistan turned out to require 855 steps and 5 years. So, instead, Kashaf requires the husband to sign a document pledging that he will never evict his wife, even if he divorces her. Roshana was selected to be one of the early Ashoka Fellows, working with Bill Drayton. That put her in touch with other social entrepreneurs around the globe, building connections and exchanging ideas. By 2009, Kashaf had 1,000 employees and 300,000 clients, and was aiming for 1 million clients by 2010. Roshana cultivated a cadre of skilled female managers with management training programs and sessions drilling staff in the 7 habits of highly effective people. Kashaf also started a bank so that it could accept deposits as well as make loans. People usually think of microfinance in terms of loans, but savings are perhaps even more important. Not all poor people need loans, but all should have access to savings accounts. And if the family savings are in the woman's name and thus in her control, that gives her more heft in family decision-making. An in-house evaluation concluded that by the time the borrowers have taken their third loan, 34% have moved above the poverty line in Pakistan. A poll found that 54% said their husbands respected them more, and 40% said they had fewer fights with their husbands over money. As for the sustainability of the underlying business model, Roshana says crisply, "Our return on equity is 7.5%. While microfinance has been exceptionally successful in parts of Asia, it remains an imperfect solution. Women's microbusinesses grow more slowly than men's, according to some studies, presumably because women are supposed to work from home and look after children at the same time. And these constraints also make it difficult for women-run businesses to graduate to a larger scale. Moreover, microfinance hasn't worked nearly so well in Africa as it has in Asia. That may be because it is newer there and the models haven't been adjusted, or because populations are more rural and dispersed, or because the underlying economies are growing more slowly and so investment opportunities are fewer. Poor health and unexpected deaths from AIDS, malaria, and childbirth also create loan delinquencies that undermine the model. And the micro refers to the amount of the loan, not the interest rate. It's expensive to make small loans, and so borrowers often must pay annual interest rates of 20 or 30%, a bargain compared to commercial money lenders, but a level that is horrifying to Americans or Europeans. The interest rate is fine when the money is pumped into a profitable new business, but if the money isn't invested soundly, then the borrowers become trapped in mounting debts. Then they are worse off than before, and we've heard of that happening to women in Kashof's programs. Microfinance is not a panacea, Roshana says. You need health, you need education. If I were prime minister for a day, I would put all our resources in education. Not everybody can walk away from an international financial career like Roshana and Sadaf and start an institution like Kashof. But absolutely anybody can join them in arranging microloans to needy women like Saima by going to a website, www.kiva.org. Kiva is the brainchild of a young, tech-savvy American couple, Matt and Jessica Flannery, who visited Uganda and saw the power of microfinance there. They knew that Americans would like to lend if only they knew the recipient. So Matt and Jessica thought, why can't a website make the connection directly? That's when they started Kiva. If you go to the Kiva website, you see people all over the world who want to borrow to finance small businesses. These would-be borrowers are vetted by a local, on-the-ground microfinance organization. A donor funds a Kiva account with a credit card and then browses among the possible borrowers on the site to figure out to whom to lend money. The minimum loan is $25. Our own Kiva portfolio at the moment consists of loans to a pancake saleswoman in Samoa, an Ecuadorian single mother who has turned part of her home into a restaurant, and a woman furniture maker in Paraguay. One reason microloans are almost always made to women rather than to men is that females tend to suffer the most from poverty. Mortality data show that in famines and droughts, it is mostly girls who die, not boys. A remarkable study by an American development economist, Edward Miguel, found that in Tanzania, extreme rainfall patterns, either droughts or flooding, are accompanied by a doubling in the numbers of unproductive old women killed for witchcraft compared to normal years. Other murders do not increase, only those of witches. The weather causes crop failures, leading to worsening poverty. And that's when relatives kill elderly witches, whom they otherwise would have to feed. Another reason for making women and girls the focus of anti-poverty programs has to do with an impolitic secret of global poverty. Some of the most wretched suffering is caused not just by low incomes, but also by unwise spending by men. It is not uncommon to stumble across a mother mourning a child who has just died of malaria for want of a $5 mosquito bed net, and then find the child's father at a bar where he spends $5 each week. Several studies suggest that when women gain control over spending, less family money is devoted to instant gratification and more for education and starting small businesses. Because men now typically control the purse strings, it appears that the poorest families in the world typically spend approximately 10 times as much, 20% of their income on average, on a combination of alcohol, prostitutes, candy, sugary drinks, and lavish feasts as they do on educating their children. The economists Abhijit Banerjee and Esther Duflo examined spending among the very poor, those who earn less than a dollar a day in some countries, less than $2 a day in others, in 13 nations. They found that these impoverished families spend 4.1% of their money on alcohol and tobacco in Papua New Guinea, 5% in Udaipur, India, 6% in Indonesia, and 8.1% in Mexico. In addition, in Udaipur, the median household allocated 10% of its annual budget to weddings, funerals, or religious festivals, often involving conspicuous consumption. 90% of South Africans spent money on festivals, as did a majority of people in Pakistan, Ivory Coast, and Indonesia. Roughly 7% of the total spending of the poorest people in India's Maharashtra state went to sugar. Go to little village shops in Africa or Asia and you'll see plenty of candy for sale, but rarely vitamins or mosquito nets. There's no precise data, But in much of the world, even some of the poorest young men, both single and married, spend considerable sums on prostitutes. Among the poor in Udaipur, people seem by any measure to be malnourished. 65% of men have a body mass index that makes them underweight by World Health Organization standards. Only 57% of adults said they had enough to eat throughout the year, and 55% are anemic. Yet at least in Udaipur, the malnutrition could in most cases be eliminated if families bought less sugar and tobacco. In contrast to the profligate spending on sugar and alcohol, the most impoverished families on the globe appear to spend about 2% of their incomes educating their children, even though that is the most reliable escalator out of poverty. If poor families spent only as much on educating their children as they do on beer and prostitutes, there would be a breakthrough in the prospects of poor countries. Girls, since they are the ones kept home from school now, would be the biggest beneficiaries. Perhaps it seems culturally insensitive to scold the poor for indulging in festivals, cigarettes, alcohol, or sweets that make life more fun. Yet when resources are scarce, priorities are essential. Many African and Indian men now consider beer indispensable and their daughter's education a luxury. The service of a prostitute is deemed essential. A condom is a frill. If we're trying to figure out how to get more girls in school or how to save more women from dying in childbirth, the simplest solution is to reallocate spending. One way to do that is to put more money in the hands of women. One early pair of studies found that when women hold assets or gain incomes, family money is more likely to be spent on nutrition, medicine, and housing, and consequently, children are healthier. In Ivory Coast, one study focused on the different crops that men and women grow for their private kitties. Men grow coffee, cocoa, and pineapple, and women grow plantains, bananas, coconuts, and vegetables. Some years, the men's crops have good harvests, and the men are flush with cash. In other years, it is the women who prosper. Money is to some extent shared. But even so, Professor Duflo found that when the men's crops flourish, the household spends more money on alcohol and tobacco. When the women have good crops, the households spend more money on food, particularly beef. Several other studies also suggest that women are more likely than men to invest scarce cash in education and small businesses. In South Africa, one study examined the impact on child nutrition when the state pension system was extended to blacks after the collapse of apartheid. Suddenly, many grandparents received a significant cash infusion, topping out at $3 per day or twice the local median income. When the pensions went to grandfathers who cared for children, the extra cash had no impact on the children's height or weight. But when the pension went to a grandmother, there was a major impact. In particular, the granddaughters grew significantly in both height and weight, and such girls became taller and heavier than girls raised by grandfathers. That suggests that if one purpose of cash transfers is to improve the health of children, it's better to direct the transfers to women than to men. Half a world away, in Indonesia, a woman continues to control economic assets that she brought into a marriage. A study found that if the wife has brought more resources into the marriage and thus has more spending afterward, then her children are healthier than those of families of equal wealth where the assets belong to the man. What matters to the children's well-being isn't so much the level of the family's wealth as whether it is controlled by the mother or by the father. As Duflo says, when women command greater power, child health and nutrition improves. This suggests that policies seeking to increase women's welfare in case of divorce or to increase women's access to the labor market may impact outcomes within the household, in particular child health. Increasing women's control over resources, even in the short run, will improve their say within the household, which will increase child nutrition and health. One implication is that donor countries should nudge poor countries to adjust their laws to give more economic power to women. For example, it should be routine for a widow to inherit her husband's property rather than for it to go to his brothers. It should be easy for women to hold property and bank accounts, and countries should make it much easier for microfinance institutions to start banks. Women now own just 1% of the world's titled land, according to the UN. That has to change. To its credit, the U.S. government has pushed for these kinds of legal changes. One of the best American foreign aid programs is the Millennium Challenge effort, and it has nudged recipients to amend legal codes to protect women. For example, Lesotho wanted Millennium Challenge money but did not allow women to buy land or borrow money without a husband's permission. So the United States pushed Lesotho to change the law, and in its eagerness to get the funding, it did so.